Welcome to the podcast, The Caring Scientist, Mission Sustainable. This is the podcast where we discuss sustainability in science and we give you hands-on tips on how you can reduce the environmental impact of your lab work.
Welcome to this episode of our podcast. My name is Adriana.
And I'm Nicoline.
And the topic of this episode is minus 70 versus minus 80 degrees Celsius for ultra-low temperature freezers. So in this episode, we have interviewed two scientists from different labs and institutes of the University of Copenhagen who have adjusted their freezer temperatures to minus 70 instead of minus 80. So you will hear how they decided to change, how they got people on board, and which sample types they now store at minus 70. So hopefully, this will give you, the listeners, some inspiration and motivation to fight for minus 70 in your lab too. So welcome, Nikolai Lervel Hansen. Can you introduce yourself?
Thank you. I'm Nikolai and I work at Section for Plant Biochemistry at the University of Copenhagen. And in my daily work, I do a lot of wet lab work and we use many freezers. So it's been a topic whether we should change from minus 80 to minus 70. And 1.5 years ago, when we purchased two new ultra-low temperature freezers, it was decided by the group leaders together that let's try with minus 70. And it's been such a good experience.
That's great to hear. So before we go into the minus 70 details, maybe you can tell us what kind of research you're doing. So what does plant biochemistry actually entail?
One thing is like describing the chemical composition of plants. This is a long tradition in plant biochemistry that you have so many plants out there and they are so different from us. What they have that we don't have is a chemical defense that has evolved through evolution. So a lot of science is about describing this, mapping it and seeing what components are bioactive. And what components can be used in a good way by society. For medicines, for example, or in agriculture. In agriculture, you might have some plant metabolites that can be used as pesticide controls, stuff like that. A newer line has been that you look at these metabolites that are interesting and you try to deconvolute how they are made by the plants and you discover the enzymes that create them. And then what you do is that you try to make a system outside of the plant that can produce the metabolites of interest.
Great. And how was the use of minus 70 degrees introduced in your department? Was that like a top-down decision that you all had to start using minus 70 degrees for long-term storage? Or how was it, like, who decided what temperature to use?
It's been up to individual researchers to decide. It was agreed on, and I think everybody was okay with it. But you can choose minus 80 if you want, because it's in the basement. But those samples that are right at hand, they are at minus 70.
Ah, so there's actually a convenience aspect to it. So it's basically just quicker to access the minus 70 freezers than the minus 80 freezers.
Yeah, and I think maybe some groups have like started at minus 80 and then, this is so long down there. Okay, we moved to minus 70 and then everything was fine.
That's wonderful. Some people simply just needed an extra incentive to start using minus 70 instead of minus 80. I think this is a really good example of using a carrot instead of a stick to make people change behavior. So in your case, people were not forced to use the minus 70 freezers. But if they do, their lab lives will become slightly easier. I think that's really nice. And why do you think some people were reluctant to change in the beginning?
It's a matter of feelings, because you don't know if it's okay at 70. You just don't want to take the risk, I think. This is the sentiment of many.
I think you are so right about this. I think most people find it really scary to start storing their samples at minus 70 instead of minus 80, because what if it doesn't work out? What if you lose all your samples? And I think that's also really why it's so important that we share information about the things that can actually be stored at minus 70. So people don't have to have all these doubts and fears, but can look at data from other labs simply. So which types of samples do you mostly work with in your lab, and which of them are fine at minus 70 degrees?
We work a lot with microbiology, and we have bacteria and we have yeast cells mostly. So they will actually be fine.
That's wonderful. So I'm wondering, you said it's up to the researchers if they want to store their samples at minus 70 or minus 80, but I also know that there are certain samples that you all keep at minus 70. Can you give us some examples of those?
Yeah. Glycerol stocks of living cells or DNA or RNA, and we have those kind of things in the minus 70. Everybody has that.
That's super nice. In my experience, many people store things at the wrong temperature, either because they don't exactly know what temperature is needed or because they simply misjudge what long-term storage actually means. I mean, a few weeks or months typically doesn't really qualify as long-term, of course, depending on the specific context. But we very often don't have a clear idea about how long we need the samples for. And therefore, we just throw them in the minus 80 freezer just to be on the safe side.
Yeah. Those things that really needs long-term storage is not very many things. So I think that most places, they could have a few minus 80 freezers where you have space for the most important stuff, those things that you want to have a very long lifetime on. And those that are more replaceable, you have at minus 70.
That sounds like a really good approach. So instead of having minus 80 as a default, we could have minus 70 as a default. And then for the very precious samples that you actually need to store long term and where you don't have data from other labs, that it would be fine at minus 70, you can store it at minus 80. And in the end, it's also really random that we are storing things at minus 80 as a default, right?
Yes. The reason for having minus 80, it's not based on testing, is it? It's based on what was technically possible. Somebody invented the minus 80 freezer because it was possible to cool it that far.
Exactly. And then minus 80 became the standard, just like minus 65 or minus 70 was the standard before that.
Yeah. We have had these Friday lunch breaks for future, and they met at lunches, and then they discussed different aspects of sustainability, and they contacted different people. And after setting the freezers at minus 70, they also found other people actually working at even higher temperatures, like minus 60. And there you actually get a very economical bonus because you can buy a whole different type of freezer, which is much cheaper.
That's a really good point, I think. I mean, not only does it benefit the planet when we store samples at minus 60 instead of minus 80 or minus 70, we can also save a lot of money on equipment simply because we choose to store things at minus 60. I'm really very curious to hear which kind of samples they keep at minus 60, so we're definitely going to follow up on that. Nikolai, before we round off, do you have anything you would like to say about how to make green lab actions happen based on your experience?
Yes, it's not enough to have a few ambitious scientists walking around and trying to do something. You need to have priority from management.
I think you're so right about that. Bottom-up initiatives are awesome and they're necessary, but they won't take us all the way.
Yeah, exactly. So I think we need more incentives in how the research is conducted in order to do something. That can come from management and also from the foundations, actually.
That's a really good point. So one thing that our listeners can do, apart from advocating for increasing the temperature of their minus 80 freezers, of course, is to start the sustainability conversation with the management and also with funding bodies. We all have much more influence than we think. Well, Nikolai, thank you so much for sharing some insights into what kind of samples you store at minus 70 in your department and also how you've tried to use the carrot and not the stick to get people to use minus 70 for storing their samples.
Yeah, and thank you, Nicolina and Adriana, for inviting me. It's been so pleasant to talk.
So you just heard from Nikolai, and now you will hear from Shirin how her lab went from discussing minus 70 to actually implementing it.
Okay, so maybe you can start with introducing yourself.
Yeah, so my name is Shirin, and I'm a PhD student at the Center for Protein Research here in Copenhagen. And I'm also the chair of CPR Goes Green, a little grassroots organization that was started by you, Nico. And Yeah, I took over after you left, and then we decided to continue collaborating on a lot of different projects together, which is great, which I'm enjoying a lot. Within CP Agos Green, we're still working on different fronts, basically, within the institute. So we're organizing different talks, topics of sustainability in the everyday lab work. And we are trying to improve different things within the institute when it comes to waste sorting to make things as easy as possible for the users, because it takes a lot of time. And in the group of people that we are, we have a lot of energy and motivation to invest it into this.
Amazing. Nicely introduced. Yeah, actually, CP Agos Green was together with me organizing the Sustainable Research Symposium last year. So that's one of the things we did together.
Yes, exactly.
So the reason why you and I are chatting now, that's because your lab decided to adjust the freezer temperatures from minus 80 to minus 70. Well done.
Thank you.
I know that this has been in the making for a while, so maybe you can tell us, when did you start discussing this, and like how long did it take for you to actually go from thinking about it to making the decision to do it?
Yeah, sure. So I think the first time that we started to talk about this was probably 3 years ago, when we started to look closer into how to improve our footprint, our laboratory footprint, basically. And one of the main things that you could do is actually adjust the temperatures and also think a little bit more about what you actually have in which freezers and fridges. Bringing that up at a lab meeting was a fun event at that time, because I think people were not very open to change, and they were very worried that it would have an impact or compromise the samples that we have stored in there. So the first feedback that we had during that lab meeting was not very constructive, I would say. I think something that is always a problem within science is that people are worried that it will either take a lot of work and time, or that it compromises experiments. And why would you change a running system? This kind of mindset, right? So that was the first time when we started talking about it. And then we said, okay, maybe we're going to drop this for now and focus on other things within the lab, started to focus more on waste sorting, on buying things in bulk, and very, very standard things to start with. And then we enrolled in the freezer challenge 1.5 years ago, I think, with our lab. And one part was again to check if we're able to actually change the temperature of our freezers. And then we brought it up at a lab meeting again, and people start to be more open towards it, not completely convinced. And many of them were still worried about samples and the things that we have stored in there and so on. So we discussed it, and people wanted to see more evidence and more data on long-term storage and what it actually means for samples that are stored in there and so on. So we started to look a little bit into it, and then agreed, okay, if people have a bad feeling about it, then we're not going to do it for the freezer challenge. But at least we brought it up again. So it was a continuous process, I would say. And then now, during the LEAF certification that we're going through at the moment, one part again is that we have to look into our freezers and think about if it's possible to adjust the temperature and make a conscious decision about this. And this is really something where I also brought it up at the lab meeting, saying that we don't have to change the temperature, but we need to know why we're not doing it. Because I said, I mean, I completely understand any fear that anybody has when it comes to valuable samples, because there is a lot of work and a lot of money that is stored in those minus 80 freezers. But we need to make a conscious decision about it and have proper reasons to do this. And people agreed, which was super nice. And a lot of people said, yeah, actually, maybe there are a few things that don't have to be in the minus 80 freezers. Maybe they can also be stored at minus 70. And people started to be a lot more curious and look into things themselves, which was nice. And when we realized that people are more open to it, a colleague of mine was willing to look through all the kits that we have in there to double check what the recommendations are from the suppliers. And we made it a bit of a lab thing, I think, to double check, send a few more emails, and in the end, we're able to convince everybody with reorganization and also getting rid of a lot of stuff that is stored in there. Nobody actually knew anymore what it was and decided on actually doing it.
Amazing. I think there are some really important points to take out from your story. One is the patience. In most labs, people will not buy into the idea immediately and be like, yes, let's do this tomorrow. I mean, maybe it does take, sadly, a few years, could also be half a year or a few months, to let people get used to the idea, to check up on things, to show them the data and all of this. So patience is a key word, but also data, right? It's not that they just thought about it and they let go of their fear. It's also because the fear and anxiousness was addressed with facts, or at least, let's say, experience from other labs having stored whatever samples, right? Maybe can you say a little bit about what kind of data you found or how you actually looked into that, you and the colleagues?
So first of all, we have a lot of kits, as I mentioned before, that are stored in there. And there, I think it's very easy to actually look into the manufacturer's recommendation. And most of the manufacturers recommend a storage between, minus 50 and minus 120 degrees. And if it's such a broad range, then obviously it doesn't matter if it's minus 70 or if it's minus 80, basically. So that was actually super interesting to see also for all of us, because obviously we've never checked these things.
No.
And the other part was that we talked to a protein production facility that we have within the institute. And they've mentioned that a lot of the proteins that we have stored at minus 80 in our minus 80 freezers are actually also stable at minus 70. So this is not gonna impact them at all. And I think because they have the expertise in the field, and there were a lot of other labs who are already storing their proteins at minus 70 instead of minus 80, we were a lot more open also to think about, okay, we could do this. And then in the end, we had a long list of our inventory in those minus 80s. And there were only two things where we felt, okay, we're not completely sure what to do about this. And there is no data out there that we could find. One of this was basically C. elegans. We are not completely sure because they are actually a lot more sensitive towards temperature changes. And then a few enzymes where it's also a bit more delicate. And then we decided, okay, you know what, the things where we couldn't find any data on and where we at the moment at least maybe not have the resources or the capacities to test it, we could reorganize our minus 80 because we have one common minus 80 freezer on our floor, for example, and then our own for our group. And we said if we reorganize things where we don't feel comfortable in actually putting them into a minus 70, we can store them at minus 80 in the common freezer in our space, but just reorganize the space a lot better and more efficiently, and have then everything else that we can store at minus 70 in the minus 70 freezer, basically.
That really sounds like the ultimate solution, because then for the things where you feel certain, and not just feel it, but you can see data, you can keep it at minus 70, but the things where we're not sure about this, there's no data to support it, we can have a tiny space in another minus 80 or in a minus 80 freezer to keep it there. And then hopefully one day we will see some data coming out saying either it has to be at minus 80 or it can be at minus 70. So you can make a decision on that.
I think the problem also is that most of the people in labs who are organizing these things, their goal is not to publish data on storage conditions, right?
No.
So actually finding good recommendations and good papers that show how they've stored their materials is something where I would love to see that in the future being included in the material and methods section, just so then people see, oh, you know what, their bacteria strands, they've stored them for 15 years at, I don't know, minus 20 degrees without any problems, or minus 60 degrees. And this would already give you an idea that other labs are doing it without any complications, right? So this would be nice to have. But the problem is that I would say at least at the moment, most of the people who are organizing these things, they don't want to spend too much time on testing different freezer conditions.
Exactly. Also because in principle, if you would do the scientific test of this, you would have to have at least n equals 3, like the same conditions except for the temperature, for several years, right? Because we're talking long-term storage.
Exactly.
And nobody is going to have a minus 70 and a minus 80 freezer containing exactly the same samples at exactly the same spot in the freezer also, because the temperatures differ across the freezer space, right? This is just very unlikely to happen.
Exactly.
But I think it's a great idea that if you would actually write it in the materials and methods, that's a very easy way to convey the message that this can be stored at whatever temperature.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, I have to say, looking into also bacterial strains that we have stored there was really an eye-opener to me, because, I don't know, in my head, all of them are stored at the same temperature, and then that's going to be fine. And obviously, it makes sense that all of them have different preferences and need to be kept at different preferences to have them efficiently working for whatever you're going to purify in them afterwards, for example. It was actually also scientifically super helpful to look into this and check and know also which kind of strands we have. So
yeah, I'm just going to say that we're going to put some links in the show notes where there's some data, also like collection of data from different universities in the world and what samples they are storing at minus 70 or even minus 20. And now I'm thinking, we already touched upon it, but I think it's an important point to make also that this is not just green in the sense that you're saving energy, but also the freezer is very likely to live longer. That means you're extending the lifetime of the equipment, which is great in terms of climate impact. But also the whole reorganization of samples and actually looking at what's junk and what's useful. Can you say something about that?
Yeah, for sure. So I would say we are one of the best organized labs that I've ever worked in so far. So I'm very happy about that. But we had, for example, in our minus 80, the so-called chaos box, which was something where everything was just put in there that we couldn't figure out what it was or whom it belonged to. Or yeah, so we literally called it the chaos box. And this was now the perfect time to actually look into every sample that was in there. And Javi and another colleague of mine did a fantastic job in taking up dry ice and doing different sessions of actually going through everything in that box and trashing things that are just not useful anymore and that were, yeah. And we could generate a lot of space in that minus 80, which is, of course, great. And that opened the possibility of ordering new racks to store also kits and other things in a more efficient more convenient way, basically in our minus 80. So now we have a fantastic overview of every little thing that is in there and have every space also dedicated to a specific task, basically.
Yeah. I'm guessing it's really easy to work in a lab, or at least easier when you know where to find things.
Oh, yeah.
But also, for example, every time you open the door to the freezer and you actually have to look through a chaos box, everything in that freezer will potentially increase in temperature because it does change the temperature in there when you have the door open. So it also compromises the work that is already in the freezer when you don't know exactly where to find things in your freezer, right?
Absolutely.
And then all labs that I ever met, they are complaining about the lack of freezer space, right? So that's definitely a plus too, I would say.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah.
I was thinking maybe from the top of your head, can you mention some of the samples that you now keep, or sample types that you now keep at minus 70 instead of minus 80?
So, I mean, there are a few proteins, for example, purified proteins that we're planning on keeping at minus 70. A lot of commercial kits to do protein purifications, for example, or to do other specific assays that we use in the lab are stored or will be stored at minus 70. And then every one of us in our lab has a personal space basically in the minus 80, and it helped a lot for people to actually clean up their shelves and look into what kind of samples they have in there and that should be stored. I mean, for example, cell lines should be stored in our nitrogen tanks just because it's better for them and they're longer usable. So they cleared up a lot of space by actually bringing down their samples to our nitrogen storage space and realizing that they had experiments stored in there that weren't supposed to be in there anymore. I think that's mostly it. And then we have a few bacteria strands that we're using on a daily basis, for example, that are now stored at minus 70 as well.
Nice. I think an important point is, I mean, of course, it's better to store something at minus 80 compared to the liquid nitrogen tank. But if the samples should be kept in the liquid nitrogen tanks, then put them there, right? Unless it's like day to day or week to week or whatever samples where, you know, if it's not long term, then a lot of things can be kept at higher temperatures, right? That also goes for, yeah, things that you would normally keep at, let's say, minus 20 or whatever.
Absolutely. And I think the good thing was that people actually had a look at, okay, maybe this is something that I use, as you say, from a week to week basis. And there it actually doesn't matter if it's stored at minus 80 or minus 70. But people started to look into this. People were curious and interested in figuring out what the optimal conditions are and why they want to put it where.
Amazing. Thank you very much for sharing your experience and your great achievement of actually getting the lab to accept a temperature increase from minus 80 to minus 70, Shirin.
Thank you. Thanks for having me here. I feel honored to be on your podcast.
You'll probably be back. Let's see.
Thank you so much for listening. And if you want to get in touch, please feel free to email us at podcast@avasustain.com. That is podcast@avasustain.com. We have also put this email address and other useful links in the notes below this podcast. Till next time.